To Daniel chapter 2, please. Time's rushing on, so we'll go straight into it now, and then if we have the time at the end, we can perhaps have a hymn or a prayer. Daniel chapter 2. Now, in the first chapter of the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar attacked the city of Jerusalem, and he took into captivity, as David's been telling us, princes of noble birth, and Daniel was one of them. It was very soon after this that Nebuchadnezzar had the dream that we all probably know about in chapter 2. Well, can we have the first piece up then, please? Thanks. Now, you should all have a handout of this. It's printed. It's very similar to the one that's on there. It just explains to you the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw. You may find it helpful just to have it in front of you while we're going through. Now, back in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 1, we're told that it was the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar that Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. That's rather an interesting expression because it rather suggests that he saw this more than once. It was very vivid. It was like a nightmare and it kept coming back and he wanted to know what it was all about. And so in verse 2 of the chapter, he calls together all his wise men, people who claim to know about such matters, and so he asks them what it was all about. In verse 5, after they said, well, you tell us what you've seen, and then we'll tell you what it means. In verse 5, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses be made a dunghill. Now, in a way, the authorised translation is a little bit unfortunate there, because it leads people to think that the king has forgotten the dream. That's not the case. If you look at almost any other translation, it will make it plain to you that it was the command that had gone forth. He wasn't saying he'd forgotten the dream. The thing there in verse 5 is the command that had gone forth, that if they didn't tell him what he'd seen and the interpretation, they would die. A modern translation, for example, puts it like this. This is what I have firmly decided. So here was a very strict instruction to his wise men that if they couldn't tell him what he'd seen and the interpretation, then they would die. Well, why wouldn't Nebuchadnezzar tell them what he'd seen anyway? Well, he realised that this was no ordinary dream. And he wanted to be absolutely sure that they were telling the truth. Now, if they could tell him what he'd seen in his mind, if they could do that, then he could be sure that they knew what they were talking about when they told him what it meant. You see, as he says in verse 8, I know of a certainty that you would gain the time because ye see the thing, the command is gone from me. But if you will not make known unto me the dream, there's but one decree for you, for ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. So you see, he knew that if he told them what he'd seen, they'd just make up a pack of lies, just to satisfy the king to save their own skins. So he didn't give them that opportunity. He said, now you've got to tell me what I've seen before you tell me what it means. Well, of course, the wise men of Babylon couldn't possibly do this. It's not something that men can do anyway, is it? And so the decree went out that they were all to be killed. And when Daniel and his friends heard about this, Daniel said that he would show the king his dream. And being a man of faith, we find in verses 17 to 19 that first of all he went and he prayed to God about it. And all the way through the book of Daniel, we find that the importance of prayer, keeping in communication with God, is being emphasized to us. And in this instance, God revealed to Daniel the secret of the dream. And you can just imagine how rapidly Daniel would have been ushered in to see the king. And what Daniel actually described to Nebuchadnezzar was something like this. He had seen a great image made up of different metals, head of gold, breast and arms of silver, belly and the sides of brass, legs of iron, and the feet a mixture of iron and clay. And then while Nebuchadnezzar was studying this dream, his mind was moved to the background of the picture when he could see a mountain. And all of a sudden there was a stone being cut out of it without human hands, which then comes into the foreground of the picture, and it hits the image right on the feet there. The image collapses, it disintegrates, and that stone becomes a great big mountain, and it fills the whole earth. So that was what Nebuchadnezzar actually saw. And now that Daniel had described that to him, he could be certain that Daniel also knew what it meant. Come down then to verse 37 of Daniel chapter 2. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. So there's no doubt about it, it was Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, representing Babylon, that was actually the head of gold. Now if you think about it, if Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, it's reasonable to assume that he saw his own face in the image. And that is perhaps why he was so determined to get to the bottom of this particular vision. If he'd seen that image and his own face as the head of gold, he'd want to know what it was all about. And so Daniel says, there you are, Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. But it didn't end there, of course, did it? Because in verse 39, and after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, represented on the image by the less precious metal of the silver. Now we've got the benefit of history to tell us what actually happened. This part of the prophecy actually came to pass after Nebuchadnezzar's death, but still in Daniel's own lifetime. Round about the year 539 BC, the armies of King Cyrus attacked the city of Babylon. Now Cyrus was king over a joint realm of Medes and Persians, hence the two arms of the image representing the two parts of Cyrus's empire. And the city of Babylon quite quickly fell. But even the Medo-Persian Empire, great as it was, and you'll see from your maps, it was a much bigger empire than the Babylonian Empire, even that empire wasn't going to last forever. Because Daniel went on to say, at the end of verse 39, that there would be another third kingdom of brass which shall bear rule over all the earth. So this Medo-Persian Empire was going to be superseded by another greater empire, because it says in verse 39 that it was going to bear rule over all the earth. And the third kingdom was represented there on the image by the belly and the thighs of brass. And again, history can help us to fill in the details. We find that eventually the Medo-Persian Empire was superseded by the greater empire of Greece under its military leader, Alexander the Great. Bronze, it says brass, but it was probably bronze actually in those days. Bronze was a very appropriate symbol for the Greeks. Even one of their own poets, Homer, spoke of the brazen-coated Greeks. As a matter of fact, when Alexander first began to reign, the Persian Empire was 50 times larger than the whole of Greece, and it contained 20 times as many people. And yet in the space of a mere 13 years, Alexander overran that empire, and the Greek kingdom filled the civilized world. And so it was that the next part of the prophecy came to pass. Verse 40. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. Now there's your fourth kingdom. And the implication is that this fourth kingdom would be the strongest of all so far. And again, it's probably very familiar territory to most of you, but it's not difficult to see what this fourth empire represents, as it's marked there on the map. From the confusion and warfare that followed Alexander's early death, his empire was divided up into four main parts. The two most important of these, and we'll talk about this a bit more later on, were the family of the Ptolemies, who ruled in the southern part of the empire, and the families of the Seleucids, who ruled in the north. And these two began a long series of wars against each other. And it was in the midst of this that slowly the fourth great empire of Rome arose. And gradually what was left of the Greek Empire
was brought into submission. Now, iron actually is a very appropriate symbol for this fourth great empire. And Daniel wasn't the first person to talk about it. If you'd like to keep your place in Daniel and just come back with me to the book of Deuteronomy and chapter 28, you'll find that God had foretold the rise of this iron power of Rome long before. Deuteronomy chapter 28. It's a very long chapter. In the beginning, God explains to his people all the blessings that he'd bring upon them if they were obedient. That takes up the first 14 verses. The rest of the chapter is concerned with the curses that would come upon them if they didn't obey him, as God knew they wouldn't. And so in verse 15 of chapter 28, "But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee." And as part of the cursing, come over to verse 48. "Therefore shalt thou serve thine enemies, which the Lord shall send against thee in hunger and in thirst and in nakedness and in want of all things, and he shall put a yoke of iron, a yoke of iron upon thy neck until he have destroyed thee." And there, way back in the book of Deuteronomy, God had foretold that eventually his people would be brought into subjection by the iron power of Rome, which came upon the people in the days of the New Testament, of course. But then look at verse 49. "The Lord shall bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flyeth." And there's another link with Rome. The eagle's a well-known symbol of Roman military power. The Romans use it themselves. And it's actually used in the New Testament as a figure of Rome. Do you remember the words that Jesus used in the Olivet prophecy when he said, "For wheresoever the carcass is, the carcass of Israel, there will the eagles be gathered together." It was the eagles of Rome that eventually came against the land and the city of Jerusalem and took it. And here it was, back in Deuteronomy. But he then goes on to say, "As swift as the eagle flyeth, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand." That was also true, wasn't it? Because the Latin of the Romans was a very different language from the Hebrew of the Jews. "A nation of fierce countenance." Well, later on in the book of Daniel, in the 8th chapter, the Roman Empire is spoken of as arising, having a king of fierce countenance. And what is this nation, or this king of fierce countenance, going to do? Well, he says to us in verse 51 that he shall eat the fruit of thy cattle and the fruit of thy land until thou be destroyed. And again at the end of the verse, until he have destroyed thee. That's what this iron power of Rome was going to do to Israel. It was going to destroy them. And as we know, the Romans came against the land and the city. The city was destroyed and the people were scattered. And here it was, all the way back in Deuteronomy. Well, come back then, if you will, to the book of Daniel. We saw earlier that there was significance in the fact that the image there has got two arms of silver, representing the two parts of the Medo-Persian Empire. It's also significant that there are two legs of iron. The Roman Empire, in due time, did actually come to be divided into two parts under its first so-called Christian emperor, Constantine. Rome remained the capital of the western part of the empire, and he made a city that he named after himself, Constantinople, the capital of the eastern part of the empire. But this great kingdom of Rome, great as it was, wasn't going to last forever. Eventually it was overthrown, or at least the western part was overthrown, by repeated barbarian invasions from the north, until in about 476 AD, the city of Rome itself fell. In the east, it was a different story, because the Eastern Empire was eaten away gradually by the rising power of Islam, but the city of Constantinople didn't fall for another 1,000 years, until 1453 AD. And it's at this point that we find the vision actually bringing us into the present. That's a quick run-through of the detail of the past. But when you actually get down to the feet of iron and clay, you find that Daniel's, is in the interpretation, is bringing us into the present day. Let's have a look at verse 41 then of chapter 2. Whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken, or brittle, or weak. And since the fall of the Roman Empire, we've actually been living in the feet of this image. The feet of iron and clay represent the modern world in which we live, which actually had its origins in the old Roman Empire, because as the Roman Empire disintegrated, many of the territories that we recognise as countries today came out of that. So our modern European world really had its origins in the old Roman Empire. And just think what an appropriate description it is when he says it's partly brittle and partly strong. The kingdom of men he describes here are like the elements of iron and clay that simply don't mix together. They don't get on together. There's no unity. There's no cohesion. And it's just like that today in our world, isn't it? We have many kingdoms. Some of them are strong. Some of them are weak. And the elements just simply don't mix together. This century we've had two world wars. And since 1945 there have been scores of other wars throughout the world. Political instability of all kinds, and apparently endless social unrest. Well, we've almost reached the end of our interpretation of this vision, haven't we? And all of it, apart from the climax, has fallen into place just as Daniel said it would. Well, the image of chapter 2 provides the basis for the other visions that come in the prophecy of Daniel. If you come on to chapter 7... you'll find that we've now got the same kingdoms again, the same sort of ideas again, but this time they're not presented as an image, but they're presented to us as a series of beasts. It's almost as if in chapter 2 you've got the kingdom of men, as God sees it, and in chapter as men like to see it rather, as a succession of precious metals. In chapter 7 you've got the kingdom of men as God sees it, as a series of beasts. Just come to chapter 7 and in verse 1. Now, bear in mind that the vision of the four beasts came about 50 years after Nebuchadnezzar had seen the image. It was much, much later that Daniel actually had this vision. It was in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, that Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. And here Daniel explains to us what it was he actually saw in this vision. Verse 3. Four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. So these great beasts then were quite different from one another. In verse 17 he tells us that the great beasts are four, and they're four kings which arise out of the earth. So we know that once again we're dealing with four kings or kingdoms, just as we were dealing with these four empires here in the image. The first one then was a lion, if we can have that on please, Michael. Now, I'm sorry that I've chopped his paws off. The photocopier wasn't big enough to get it on. Actually, we've got four new drawings of the beast that Brother Darren Story has kindly done for us. And that's his interpretation there of the lion. This was the first one, the lion with wings. You'll find the detail in the scripture text if you'd like to have a look at chapter 7, verse 4. The first beast was like a lion and had eagle's wings. But it didn't end there, you notice. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, that's what he first saw, that lion with eagle's wings. But it changed while he was watching it, didn't it? The wings were plucked, it was made to stand on its feet, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, if we could have the second one then, Michael. This is an older drawing, and that suggests the change in the lion. There you've got the man's heart, it's got given a man's head there. The wings have been plucked. That's an idea of how it changed. So there are two stages then to this first beast. A lion, it's a beast with eagle's wings, and then the wings are plucked, it stands up like a man, a man's heart is given to it in place of its beast's heart. What do we make of all that? As a matter of fact, the Bible itself gives us a very clear indication. Keep your finger in Daniel 7 and come back to Jeremiah in chapter 50. We look at some pictures like that and we think they look very odd because we're not used to seeing them. But I doubt if Daniel would have been as surprised as we are, actually, because carved winged beasts were known to have adorned the palaces of Nineveh, the Assyrian times, and also Babylon, and you can actually go and see examples of them in the British Museum. He probably would have been quite familiar with carved winged beasts of this sort. Jeremiah chapter 50 and verse 17. Israel, said the prophet Jeremiah, is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. The lions have driven him away. And who were they? First, the king of Assyria hath devoured him. And last, this Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, hath broken his bones. And there Jeremiah is describing for us the Assyrians and the Babylonians as being lions who came against the land of Israel. Now, actually, the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire were basically the same empire. All that happened, really, was that the capital shifted from Nineveh in the north down to Babylon in the south. And often in the Bible, they're treated of as the same thing. And here they're both described as being lions. So here, then, Jeremiah is talking about the approaching invasion of the land of Israel, and he talks about these two empires as being lions. Now, in chapter 7 of Daniel, the lion has wings. So what were the wings? Back to Isaiah and chapter 8. The wings. We can be sure that the lions represent powers, Assyria and Babylon, the same power basically. Come back to Isaiah chapter 8 and you'll find out what is meant by the wings. Now here the prophet Isaiah is talking about an Assyrian invasion of the land of Israel, which actually happened, you may remember, during the reign of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when King Sennacherib of Assyria came down against the land of Judah, and although he was defeated in the end, of course, by the power of God, he did an awful lot of damage. Now, here in chapter 8 and verse 7, Isaiah is talking about this. Now therefore behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria, and all his glory. And he shall come up over all his channels, and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah, which he did. And he shall overthrow and overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. So can you see how the Bible is using the idea of wings? When the Assyrians came down against Judah, the Assyrian power stretched out his wings over the land of Judah. In other words, he encompassed it, he took it, he seized it. Although, of course, miraculously, God defeated him in the end. Well, in due course, this great empire that's spoken of here had its wings plucked. Its wings were plucked. And the centre of its power moved south to Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar rebuilt this empire, and he made it to stand up. So it's the Assyrian part of it then, the first part of this empire that has the wings are plucked, the centre of power shifts south from Nineveh to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar is the new king, and he makes this empire once again to stand up on its feet. And it says that a man's heart was given to it now. Well, it does seem from some of the inscriptions that they've found that Nebuchadnezzar made the empire more civilized and humane than it had been before. Perhaps this was the influence of some of his Jewish captives, especially men like Daniel, who were right there speaking to the king, probably from day to day, you see. But Nebuchadnezzar was also a man who was responsive to God's teaching from time to time. You see, in chapter 4, in response to a lesson that God had taught him, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, said this: "I praise and extol and honour the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he's able to abase." Well, you never found sentiments like that from the lips of the old Assyrian kings. So Nebuchadnezzar then was the beast in its second phase, with the man's heart given to it. Right, we must move on very quickly. Come down to Daniel chapter 7 and verse 5. Can we have the second overhead then, please, Michael? Chapter 5, and there you've got a great big bear. And this again, I should say, is one of Darren's drawings. "And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh." Well, Jeremiah has helped us to identify the lion with Babylon, so we can easily match up the first beast with the head of gold. This next power, as we discovered from the image, was the Medo-Persian kingdom. And if you look again at verse 5, you'll see that it's depicted as a bear which raised itself up on one side. So in other words, one side is higher than the other. And that was exactly how the Medo-Persian Empire developed. Initially, the Medes were the most important, but under Cyrus the Great, who we read about in the book of Daniel, the Persian elements became the most important. And so in verse 5, it's the Persian side of the bear that is actually raised up. Actually, the same idea, using a different figure, is to be found in chapter 8. So look at chapter 8 and verse 3. It's exactly the same thing again, but the figure's changed. "Then Daniel said, I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram." So it's not a bear this time, but it's a ram, "which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last." So that's the Medo-Persian Empire with two horns, and the higher horn, the Persian horn, came up last. And in case you're in any doubt that we're interpreting this in the right way, if you look at verse 20 of the same chapter, Daniel tells us exactly what it is. "The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia." So we're absolutely sure here that we're onto the right interpretation, that we're understanding God's word correctly. Right, so it's the Medo-Persian Empire. But you'll remember back in verse 5 of chapter 7 that this bear had three ribs in its mouth, and you can see them there in the picture. Three ribs in its mouth. What did they mean? Well, if you look at verse 5 of chapter 7 again, you'll see that the bear is said to devour much flesh. In other words, it gobbled up a great deal of land and people. And if you look at your map, you'll see that the Persian Empire certainly is much larger than the old Babylonian Empire was. There have actually been a number of suggestions as to what these three ribs are. So I ought to say, as a preface to my remarks, that this is another suggestion. Wouldn't put it dogmatically. But it seems to me that as these three ribs are concerned with the devouring of much flesh, we can link up verse 5 of chapter 7 with verse 4 of chapter 8. Just have a look at that and see what the Persian Empire did. "I saw the ram pushing westward, northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand." Now, here you've got a bear with three ribs in its mouth. The ribs are linked up to the eating of much flesh. And here in chapter 8 and verse 4, you've got three geographical directions where the bear ate up territory. And so we're suggesting that they're the three ribs of chapter 7. Westward, northward and southward. Can we have the next one then, Michael, please? Back to chapter 7 now, and we're down to our next beast, the leopard. Verse 6. "After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and the dominion was given to it." So here we've got a leopard,
you go back to your image, it corresponds to the next section, the belly and the thighs of brass. It's the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great had brought this great Persian dominion into submission by about the year 330 BC. And his conquests were achieved with astonishing speed. And that's why he's depicted as a leopard. You see, a leopard is a very swift, small animal. It represents Alexander very well. On the other hand, the bear was a good figure of the Persians, because the Persians were really like a slow, lumbering bear in the way they used to fight. The way the Persians fought was literally to throw everything at the enemy. They tried to crush the enemy by force of numbers. Alexander, on the other hand, went in for good strategy and good tactics. Very often he was outnumbered in his battles. The Greeks really were like a swift, fast-moving leopard. But it's got four heads. Well, Alexander died childless at the very early age of 32. He caught marsh fever in Babylon and died. And then his vast empire that stretched from Greece right over to India was divided up eventually among his generals, and four of them in particular. And they're represented there by the four heads of the leopard. And finally, the fourth overhead, please, Michael. And we're back to Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. We've got something very different. Now, actually, Daniel doesn't liken this to any living known animal at all. He couldn't do it. It was something that was totally different. And now we've got Darren's interpretation of it. Well, have a look at verse 7 then of Daniel chapter 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. He can't liken it to any known animal this time. Dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Now, the iron teeth there help us to identify it with the iron legs in the image. So it's the power of Rome that we're looking at least initially. The Roman military machine was highly successful in devouring and breaking in pieces its opponents. And this description is particularly true of the way the Romans treated the Jews. And remember that Israel is the centre of all of this. And the idea of devouring and breaking in pieces really is a good description of how the Romans treated the land of Israel. The Jews were always a thorn in the Roman side. And eventually, in AD 70, they came along, they swept away the whole Mosaic system, and the Jews were scattered, just as Daniel had foretold. Well, for all of this, of course, for all of us, this is just history, isn't it? And hopefully, we've had to go through it very quickly this morning, but hopefully, many of the things we've been talking about have been familiar to you. Perhaps some of the passages will have been new. But it's all history, it's all actually happened. Now, this book of Daniel goes on, as we shall see later, to talk about other events which are not history. They're things which have yet to come to pass. And that ought to give us confidence that if God has already brought to pass all these things that he said in minute detail, that he will also bring to pass the other things that are left to be fulfilled. We can trust the Bible as God's word and as a guide for our lives.